One of Neil Young's crappier songs there, but kind of appropriate for this episode of Dave's Gone By here on this second day of April 2011. I just love, that's the beauty of radio, to make these little connections, these tenuous synapses of things, because, well, talking about not only how crappy the New York Mets are, and as my friend Alan just told me, it's kind of amazing that I'm giving a little piece of Mets lore and history here in Northern Colorado for absolutely no reason at all, which is one of the points of this show. And also because Alan Sherstuhl is a syndicated columnist who came up with a great column that I absolutely read every single week religiously. Rabbi Sol Solomon reads it religiously, too, which means he reads it right to left. But, oh, man, Alan, you're not laughing at that. Damn it. I'll have to work on that joke. So you know what? I'm going to let Alan Sherstuhl tell us about it. Alan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you are there. Okay, you didn't laugh at my damn joke, so I'm already angry at you. But please tell us about studies in crap.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you, Rabbi Saul, when he comes out eventually later. But hey, first, can I just say how exciting it is to be on the same show as Melanie and how great it was to finally hear the Carolina song after so many years?
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty excited to have her on, too. She's going to be
cool, Dave. And,
yeah.
The question I would like you to ask Melanie, if you can, is
sure.
Does she realize how hard it is to Google her?
Oh, because she only has that first name, and you get a zillion Melanies.
And it's tough.
Yeah, no, it's kind of like when I want to Google something about television, and I type in boobs, and you know, for boobtube, and I have to scroll through.
That's not a good move.
It takes me hours. Yeah,
I think it's Melanie, and there's a band called the that are kind of hard.
Yes. Well, if you do the in quotes, you actually I think you come away okay. You have to put quotes around stuff, but.
Or, Melanie in quotes. I don't think you have any such.
Yeah, that then.
Hey, Dave, good to talk to you.
You too, man.
So yes, I write studies in crap. I dubbed myself crap archivist in 2008 or thereabouts.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started actively collecting strange and bewildering books and magazines and ephemeral publications from thrift stores and antique malls, starting in the Kansas City area. But then slowly expanding out to California, occasionally New York, Massachusetts, and just wherever I can find it. And then writing it up, trying to be fair, but also having as much fun as possible with it.
Now, is you only started doing like the column and doing it, quote unquote, seriously a couple of years ago, but were you a crap connoisseur and collector in your teens, in your 20s, that kind of thing?
Oh, certainly. I remember the day I realized I had a gift, or maybe it's a patience, for digging through terrible books at thrift stores was sometime in late high school when I found a guide called, oh, I can't remember the exact title, but I still own it, actually, to puberty for young Catholic schoolgirls, published in, like, 1966 and 67.
Uh-huh.
And something came over me, and I looked through the index until I found, you know, phrases that amused me, and the phrase bad habits really leapt out at me. I mean, it was, you know, printed in black type, but it may as well have been printed in one of those New Testament Jesus red ink things.
Oh, yeah.
It was just seared into my brain. So I looked up the bad habits chapter, and it never really identified what these bad habits were, but it did suggest that when you go to bed, you young Catholic schoolgirl, that you wear very loose bed clothes and make sure before you fall asleep that your hands are always outside the linens.
Hmm.
And it also suggested that when bathing yourself, always take a bath, and never really use a sponge for your intimate parts, and instead just lower yourself in and out of the water so that you resist temptation to indulge in bad habits.
Oh, my God. Yeah. You know, I spent 10 years trying to convince Catholic schoolgirls to do the exact opposite. What can I tell you? and unfortunately, it's the last 10 years. No, I'm kidding. But yeah, so that sort of started you on your way. And you still have that marvelous tome?
Yes, I do, and I have saved it. I have never used it online. It is in a big stack of books I have for when I feel like, you know what, I don't have anything this week. So, you know, I've been saving some of the good stuff.
Well, that's the thing that I wonder about, because of all the things that you do, your work life, you're doing the column. You also have to go to these places, find the stuff. And sometimes, yeah, there are comic books, there are coloring books, there are children's books. But other times you go through novels. Where the hell do you find the time to read some of these full-length things just to squeeze the crap out of them?
Boy, that does get tricky some days, some weeks. You'll notice if you read the column that some weeks I'm just making fun of coloring books.
Right.
And those are the weeks when I have a regular person's life. So when I write about a novel or something, like one of my favorite things I've ever written about was a 800 or 900 page self-published novel of Joycean ambition, a novel titled Fuzzy Slippers, Pink Mules, : Came a Clown, a deeply ambitious novel about a clown, written with the most over-the-top, god-awful stream-of-consciousness style you could imagine, that slowly, as the book goes on, seems to truly descend into Tourette's territory. And I don't say Tourette's the way people say Tourette's when they're making a joke.
Right.
I say Tourette's as in, like, this sounds like a person shouting on a bus. And so it's a 900-page book, and I've had it for probably 3 or 4 years before I wrote about it. Just would pick it out occasionally, keep it in the bathroom, declaim from it randomly at parties, until finally, you know, I felt like I'd marked it up enough to where I could do it. But no, the novels certainly take a while, especially in a week, like a couple weeks ago, I wrote about 4 different 60s romance novels starring nurses, such as, like, A Nurse on Nightmare Island or Nurse's Dormitory.
Yeah.
And
I remember them well.
They're all exactly the same. Yeah, that was quite a time commitment. So I think I follow that up the next week with something like, here's 8 funny pictures of clowns from thrift stores.
You know, I'm laughing not only at what you're saying, but I did run and Google the Fuzzy Slippers, Pink Mules.
Fuzzy Slippers, Pink Mules, Came a Clown.
And actually, you're forgetting one aspect of that title of the book. It was volume one.
It was
volume one.
Oh, volume one, yes. McAllister Ransom, unfortunately, never did finish volume two.
No, oh.
He teases them at the end of the book. And the book has many, many great lines and many, many wonderful things in it. But my favorite is one rant where he really gets furious at the name of the husband of the woman who is a clown. I forget what the gentleman's name is, but McAllister Ransom, the author, takes everything in his book very personally. And so he shouts all sorts of filth about this person's name on the page, and he ends the paragraph with, "We fornicate in the cream of his name."
Actually, that's not, in another context, that would be a really wonderful insult. That'd be a really, you know, it's like the Monty Python, I fart in your general direction. In the right,
yeah. Touch with the brilliance.
Yeah. But not everything is touched.
Self-published novels are tricky. You know, most of them are just so transparently bad, but not transcendently bad. And Fuzzy Slippers, Pink Mules is obviously the work of somebody with some talent in some way, but no control or sense of proportion or artistry. And that makes it so very much more interesting to me than, the kind of books I often find, like self-published fantasy novels.
Yeah. Well, I want to share with people just a touch of this very, very important book. This book that will be, what was that book? It was, there was this guy who wrote this book on Vietnam, like a kid going through Vietnam years. They did this whole documentary. He wrote a book that was it wasn't really a bestseller, but it sold really well. It got wonderful reviews. They were calling him like the next Norman Mailer. And then he just kind of disappeared. Do you remember this?
No, not right offhand.
It's a really cool documentary. What happened was the author really loved, the documentary filmmaker really loved the book. And said, hey, whatever happened? How come he never published anything else in the past 30 years? And went to track the guy down. And it just turned out this was a pretty normal guy with a very quiet, sort of rural suburban life with all these stuff and manuscripts in his attic, and he went through some tough times and just never wrote another one. Started one, could never finish it, and he was this one book novelist, but the book was, in literary terms, really important. I wish I could remember more about it. But, I went off the rails there.
Alistair Ransom, he only did finish the one book. I think he might be the J.D. Salinger of crap.
Well, let me share this with readers. This is from Fuzzy Mule's Pink Slippers, Volume 1, Came a Clown. You know, I'm not only going to do this. I'm going to do this right. I'm going to – let's see if I can get some Chopin under it because it deserves music. It deserves a little let's see. With Elizabeth Leonskaya on the piano, here's one of the nocturnes. Here we go.
I always appreciate your dedication to quality radio.
Here we go. John Eddie Ryan III, a grade A. I'm going to raise the music here. Hopefully I can drown out what I'm reading. John Eddie Ryan III, a grade A, first class prime rib, numero uno creep. His name was all that he had. His name, his claim to fame. Would a pile of poop called another name smell sweeter? Were it perfumed with perfume of prose or poetry, 'twould sweeter smell? Would you want to eat it? 900 pages, you say? Alan, is that?
Oh, yeah. There's sometimes where it just, you know, devolves into page after page of shouted names, many exclamation points. It's quite a find. I think it is the jewel of the crap archives.
I'll do one more. Just because I got the music playing and that makes me happy. Oh, here we go. Saucy slut advanced upon April slowly, step by step, step by step, step by step. The mob thickened behind her like dropping a dry... I'm sorry. The mob thickened behind her like dropping a dry sponge into a pail of water, and the mob grew rocketing behind the saucy slut like a mushroom of hate. Oh, wow. Oh, thank you. So before I get overloaded on this fellow here, Mr. Ransom, what are some of your other favorite columns that you've done over the past, I guess, 3 years now in Studies in Crap?
Oh, well, there's one that far and away means the most to me, and that seemed to me to justify my faith and my ability to find strange crap. And that is one day, not long after starting the column, I was in a thrift store in Kansas City, a really crazy thrift store, where like the book section was just this giant dumpster. And I'm actually inside the dumpster ferreting around for probably over an hour, my fingers drying, using every sort of moisturizer I can to keep from just turning into a mummy in here. And I found a photocopied and stapled cookbook from 1978, titled Recipes from Old Cape Girardeau, you know, the kind of community cookbook that every small town does. And being from Kansas City, I know Cape Girardeau has a special significance. And so I picked up the cookbook and I flipped through it, hoping. And yes, there was exactly what I hoped for when I saw the words Old Cape Girardeau. Uh-huh. There were recipes by Rush Limbaugh's grandmother.
Oh,
you just can't hope for that. I mean, that's pretty remarkable. So I bought it, of course, and I went home and immediately went to the grocery store and bought all the ingredients to make a 1978 Limbaugh dish that is titled Under the Sea Salad, and it's a Jell-O dish. And as far as Jell-O, it is pretty much the Fuzzy Mule's Pink Slippers of Jell-O, I believe.
You have a picture of this on your column, and I remember this. It's just
yes. If you Google Studies in Crap and Jell-O, this will come up.
And if you ate it, would come up too.
Live Jell-O.
Yeah.
Live Jell-O, cream cheese, olives.
Oh.
Mayonnaise. Oh, I'm sorry, Miracle Whip, not mayonnaise. That would be tacky.
That's the Goyish mayonnaise.
And
yeah.
Peaches.
Peach. Okay. Well, peaches and Jell-O. Okay. But oh, I'm looking at it now. There's a cat. Yeah, but wonderful picture of the cat, like, not wanting to eat it.
Yes, and I'm very proud of that photo. That is my cat. He has made it into the column about 4 or 5 times now. Yeah. And that photo spread around the world a little bit. You know, it didn't quite go viral in any sensible way. It instead, you know, got picked up by some of the strangest websites you could ever imagine. And my favorite was the Americaner blog on a Swedish newspaper ran that photo. And then the caption beneath the photo, when I ran it through Babelfish or whatever translating software I did, said in Swedish, "Here is Mr. Limbaugh, a giant infant, before he ate his mother's food."
Well, it does look a little, well, a little fuzzier than Rush Limbaugh. But you have to understand, the Swedish, these people eat lutefisk. So compared to that, Rush Limbaugh's grandma's Jell-O is actually delicious. You know?
I'm sure it's a delicacy over there, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
And speaking of recipes, I recently found a book here in Los Angeles called Cooking with David Wade, and who hosted a very, very stuffy gourmet cooking show in the mid to late 60s, where he's wearing on the cover like this Wide World of Sports jacket that says gourmet on it. It's very funny. But a recipe from Charlton Heston called Charlton Heston's Cream Puff. And I just love those words together.
Oh, yeah.
And so we made that as well, and it was... I think it might have been worse than the Jell-O salad. When I taste tested the Jell-O salad with some friends, a very funny friend of mine said, "You know what? I have everything I need to make this Jell-O salad in my refrigerator right now." And another funny friend responded, "Well, in my apartment, I have everything I need to make a bomb, but I don't."
Yeah, I mean, literally, after looking at the Jell-O, you probably should have recommended to the friend you take everything out of the fridge that could go into that and throw it away and never, ever buy it again. Oh.
Never again will it happen.
Well, did you try the Charlton Heston cream puff? Did you make one of those?
Yes, we did. And it actually came out looking much better, but it was. It's not quite an abomination. It's not an offense to God in the way that the Limbaugh recipe is.
Right.
It's just more of a very way too craft cheesy, you know, 1960s American recipe.
From my cold flour-covered hands. Oh, yeah.
You know what? I didn't make a single joke about Planet of the Apes in that piece. I really went as far as I could to not do that. But we did include with my shot of the finished cream puff, a pistol and some bullets.
Of course, yeah. You fools! I said preheat! Preheat! No, but... Anywho, we are talking with Alan Sherstuhl on Dave's Gone By here. Alan, of course, is the columnist for Studies in Crap. And before we get to more of your career and your life, let's remind people, because it's kind of changing where people can read this now. Am I correct?
Oh, sure, and that's getting complicated these days. Oh, and one other thing, let me just add this.
Yeah.
It was Charlton Heston's tuna cheese puff.
Oh, I thought it was a dessert-y kind of a thing. I thought it was like a nice light...
No, I'm so sorry. I forgot that totally essential detail. And yes, the phrase Charlton Heston's cheese puff does really flow off the tongue.
Sure does.
But Charlton Heston's tuna cheese puff has that extra piquant kick.
Wasn't that his nickname for his wife? No, I don't know what that means. But anywho, sorry about that. Bunch.
Oh, Dave, you always go there.
I do. I can't help but go there. That's why people. That's why we have like three listeners. It's I'm very proud of them. But Alan, as I was about to say, your Studies in Crap has been on Kansas City Pitch, but it's moving. It's changing. Talk to me. Where is it?
Yeah, it's had kind of a confusing route around the country. It started out on The Pitch in Kansas City, a paper I worked for years living there, and then it started running in The Village Voice as well, which is very exciting for a Kansas City boy who used to, you know, in the early 90s, used to try to get people to drive me to the big bookstore so that I could buy The Village Voice to see if Robert Christgau was in there that week. So that was very exciting. And I moved to Los Angeles and picked up in the LA Weekly, where it's continuing to run. And I think next week it's going to start showing up in the SF Weekly. And some of these other places it might be shutting down. Oh. So it's going to continue, but it migrates around the country quite a bit.
And but it won't be in The Voice anymore? Is it still in The Voice? In New York?
It hasn't been in The Voice the last 3 weeks because of kind of complications. It's only been in the LA Weekly the last couple weeks. So it's the best way to find it is to Google Studies in Crap or to find me on Twitter where I post the links relentlessly.
Now, these are, have also been, as you said, you would go to the store to actually get the hard copy. Were these, are these places also physically publishing it on paper, papyrus, rather than Twitter and just on the internet?
Occasionally. Kansas City and L.A. have run it as a column in the paper before. At The Voice, it's always been a web-only thing. But and in Kansas City, there was, you know, there was a while where I was also writing very, you know, local history kind of studies and crap for Kansas City that would run in the paper, too.
Oh, cool.
So it's been around. They use their IPs well, the Village Voice Media Company.
Yeah.
They worked pretty good.
And but I mean, and not to be in any way specific, but as a fellow writer and journalist and stuff like that, did you get a little something-something when The Voice was running alongside with the pitch or when it would go to LA Weekly, et cetera?
Oh, sure.
Oh, that's nice. Okay, so even though it was running more than one place, you got something, as it were.
Yes, the negotiations continued long into the night, but eventually, yes, I was getting something-something besides the honor and prestige of appearing in new Village Voice.
Now let's roll it back. Talking to Alan Sherstuhl here, and Alan, as you said, I guess you got your real journalism start at the Kansas City pitch. How did you get to that point? Were you a journalism major in college, English major, what?
No, I was an English major. I was writing fiction. I was insufficiently interested in other people to be a journalist. But, you know, I mean, I did a year on not just a college newspaper, but a community college newspaper.
Ooh.
And I got kind of poached from there to come and work at one of the Kansas City weeklies that was going on at the time. And so I did that for years, you know, writing a column, reviewing shows, that kind of thing, reviewing theater, as I'm sure
you
would appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eventually moved around the country and, you know, I just kept at it, just kept working at the weeklies. And, you know, I was the theater critic in Kansas City when I started doing Studies in Crap. And I started doing Studies in Crap not because somebody came to me and said, hey, do you want to do a column making fun of funny books? I started doing it because we have the internet now and I felt like maybe we should take advantage of it and start doing things that nobody would ever have thought to put in the paper. Because I have this theory that I would like, that I always like to run by every journalist friend I know, which is that there is something that you are interested in or that you can do well that, you know, lots of people would be interested in and nobody's writing about somewhere, and maybe you should just grab a little piece of online and do it.
Absolutely. I mean, you never asked me, although you should have, but I agree. I mean, you don't have to ask me. It's an obvious thing. You follow your passion, and if you have the time and energy to do it right, either you'll end up just doing it for love, or it'll have a life of its own beyond that. So, yes, by all means. And so, but you were doing, how long were you at the pitch?
Off and on over the years at Kansas City Papers, from the mid to late 90s, and then from the early 2000s, until just last year.
Oh.
When I moved to Los Angeles.
Now, why did you move to L.A.? Did you have a job offer, or is it the master's thing that you're doing?
I came out here. I won a fellowship to the University of Southern California, or as we call it out here, Sex on the Roof College.
Whoa. Why is it called that, and I'm going tomorrow?
Well, Dave, you probably have to pledge Greek to really be able to partake of that.
Oh.
The Greek system here at USC has had several, as they put it in the campus newspaper, they currently have a perception problem because a couple weeks ago there was an infamous email that originated from a Kappa Sigma fraternity account explaining to all the members of the fraternity how they should rank their conquests.
Yeah.
And it was every kind of misogynistic, racist madness you would expect. I won't sully your airwaves by talking about it in any great detail.
Oh, sully away, yeah.
It actually opens with saying we will not refer to women by she or her. We will refer to them as pie.
Oh, no.
Not the mathematical concepts that can be divided out forever, like a good long-term relationship.
And not Rush Limbaugh's grandma's pie either. No, we're sully any further.
They use the metaphorical implication of, like, grandma pie in there somewhere. and then, 3 weeks later, Just this last week, a fraternity guy from the same frat was photographed in broad daylight on the corner of the largest building on campus, over in the pretty much the exact center of campus, really going around the world with a girl from UCLA. And it's not like they're just, you know, surreptitiously making sweet, sweet love. He was putting on a show. He was posing like he's in the Thunder from Down Under review at Las Vegas. I mean, like tents behind his back and velvet thrusting. And, of course, he's totally, totally ripped in the way of the idly wealthy fraternity sorority crowd who have had nothing to do in their lives until now except to concentrate on their physical beauty.
Well, yeah. I've been there. So, I mean, done that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've made a career out of it.
Yeah, so oh my God, and this was not apocryphal. This was absolutely real. Like this what did they arrest him or her? It's funny that it would just be him, but
kicked out of the fraternity because he has dishonored it. He did not behave like a gentleman, is what they said.
Well, also he wasn't the positions he was doing were not Greek, so that completely ticked him off.
Exactly.
Oh my God! So now it's termed locally as the Sex on the Roof College. Yeah, I'm going.
I'm totally going. We also call it Twitter Cage College. Those of us who are in my master's journalism program, because we always end up talking about Twitter and John Cage in every class.
Well, are you taking a lot of music courses there?
Mm-hmm.
No, seriously.
The only piece of John Cage music we've heard is the one where nobody plays anything.
That's my favorite. Because I can do any. In fact, I get.
I am tweeting in honor of it, which means I'm not tweeting at all.
Actually, the best mashups that I ever do, because, you know, this whole thing of mashup is this really cool thing where they take two pieces of music. I do this all the time. I take whatever I'm listening to, I mash it up with the 4 minutes of John Cage not playing the piano, and it always sounds great, you know? Okay, I did not get a laugh on that. Damn it.
I only laughed a little bit, but I was purling my own, I'm sorry to say.
Oh.
Which is that I downloaded 433, but I was dissatisfied with the bit rate.
That's, God damn you, that's better than mine. No wonder you're the new...
Oh, it's not a competition, my friend.
Oh, it's always a competition. You're a journalist. You know it's always a competition. By the way, I do have to mention that it is 11:02 in the morning here at the University of Northern Colorado in Greeley, Colorado. You're listening to Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio, which you can find on the web at uncradio.com. Also, if you are in the dorms here at the university, it's Channel 3, live streaming 24/7. Yes, and you get wonderful crap like this. Yes, Dave's Gone By interviewing the author of the weekly column Studies in Crap, Alan Sherstuhl, who's talking also now more about his academic and his journalism career. Sounds like you're having a pretty darn good time at the university, are you?
Oh, yeah, it's been a great time. I've met some great folks, taken some great classes. I'm taking some great courses from some of the professors. I'm working with Amy Bender in a fiction class. That's awfully fun.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean working with her? Are you writing pieces
I bring in things I've written and she eyeballs them and does not smack me.
That's good. that's always
really good.
Good.
Yeah, we are not collaborating on anything, no.
Now do you have
not by that.
This is your first master's, right? You have a bachelor's.
I have a master's in creative writing actually from Boston University.
Oh wow. Wow, you go, man. Did that help you? Did that help you get the Kansas City job? Did it do anything for you?
That's a very tricky question. I remember in the program, I was and when I was there, many members of my program, there were only about 10 of us, but they were rebelling a little bit. They didn't quite see what the point was of bringing in their short stories each week and then being excoriated, which is a tricky situation.
Sure.
And the director of the program, who is not there now, and who is the father of the GM of the Boston Red Sox, the director of the program said, don't decide whether or not this was all worth it for 10 years.
Hmm.
And I thought that was a pretty god-awful thing to tell people wondering why they're in your program. But now it's been about 10 years, and as I look back on it, I can say this, you know, a master's in creative writing costs a lot of money, that it buys you opportunity in a community in which you can write and even try to make something of it. And it also gave me the ability to teach college with that master's degree, which I did for years while writing for the pitch. So from that mild professional perspective, yeah, I think it was good. From a creative, artistic perspective, I think it was really, really good. But, you know, master's programs, Dave, are like that cave in The Empire Strikes Back that Yoda says, do not take your weapon in there. You only get out of them what you take in, I think.
Hmm. Okay. And are you feeling that? Are you also getting that sense in your term at University of Southern California?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, cool.
You know, at a master's program, the harder you work, the more you'll get out of it.
No.
It's given me the chance to write things I never thought I'd get to write, such as a really long critical analysis of contemporary country music.
Whoa. Okay, like 5,000 words?
Not, or nobody in the world wants to pay you for that, but at USC you can write it for credit.
Oh, very nice. And how much, I'm kind of curious about this also, of how much is stuff that you're really, really interested in and want to do, and how much is like, oh, I have to do this for credit to graduate?
It's actually, I would say, for me, it's been about 75-25, like things I want to do versus I've got to grind this out.
Nice.
With everything I've done here, you know, I've managed to be able to tailor to, I don't want to say my wheelhouse or anything, but to things I'm interested in or have wanted to explore. So, no, I've been satisfied with that.
No, that's great. And it's a short program. You're getting, well, had you even not gotten the San Francisco Weekly gig, it would have been over in a month or two, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. It's a one-year master's degree program, and there is nothing wrong with that.
No. Is it a full year? Or so? I thought it's even like 9 or 10 months or something like that. Or is it a full year?
Plus about 2 weeks at the very beginning.
Oh.
They add on. So, it is, yeah, the University of Southern California's specialized journalism program. You'll talk about Twitter. You'll talk about John Cage. You'll meet a lot of good people. And once a month, free dinner with a lot of drinks.
Oh, there you go. And you're not saying it on the air, but you did mention in one email, hot women. A lot of beautiful women. Am I right?
Oh, sure. I University of Southern California is pretty much what I, when I was 12, I thought the grotto would look like.
That's Playboy reference for people who are younger than we are.
I've made a lot of friends from other countries, and who have never been in America before.
Oh, that's cool.
And I've had a great time trying to explain the shorts worn by undergraduate women to them.
Does it really need to be explained? You know. You just point and go, God. So let me ask, first of all, you know, as I said, this is a competitive business, so I'm incredibly jealous. How did you get the SF Weekly gig?
Well, you know, I've worked with Village Voice for quite a while now because they've owned the Kansas City pitch the entire time I've been working for them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've been friendly with the people who are higher up, and they asked me a while ago to take an editorial test, and I was in the running for a couple jobs, and then, you know, San Francisco kind of fell into place.
Nice. Now, and again, at the pitch, you were also an editor, or just, and the other Kansas City?
I was a freelancer who was doing studies and crap, and theater reviews, and assorted other, you know, whatever it occurred to me, occasional cover stories, news pieces.
Is this your first editing gig? As a managing editor, is this the first gig that you got?
Oh, I did some editing of alumni magazines during a spell when I worked at Harvard. I edited some tiny music magazines years ago, but first one in a while.
Neat. When were you at Harvard? When you were at Boston U. How did you get allied?
Working at Harvard, though, is like, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, in West Virginia, you know, if you live back in the hills, you work at the still. I mean, it's just the only thing there. I was living in Cambridge, so you end up working at Harvard, which was interesting. I'm a middle-class boy from Kansas City. It was at Harvard talking to students that I first learned about things like thread counts.
Okay. Let me ask, of all the places now that there's Kansas City, there's Los Angeles, there's Boston, Cambridge. Which is your favorite? Well, I guess Kansas is still always going to be in your heart.
Oh, absolutely. It broke my heart to leave Kansas recently, but to really appreciate a place like Kansas, you have to go away from it and occasionally come back, I think.
Yeah.
And I really loved Boston. And, you know, there's an interesting, talking about studies and crap earlier and talking about, you know, kind of collecting things before I was writing the column, another one of my very favorite columns came out of my time at Harvard, where I had this job working for some alumni magazines for the graduate schools at Harvard. So mm-hmm. we would have to blur the books written by alumni.
Yeah.
And they would all submit their books. And, you know, a lot of them were very impressive books, as you would imagine. But I once got this self-published thing called Popular Anthropology. And popular was spelled P-O-P-P-U-L-A-R.
Oh, boy.
And it was written by a man named Joseph L. Popp.
And oh.
It looked to me kind of absurd.
Yeah.
And I took it home and was reading it, and I really couldn't believe it. He was trying to make a self-help book based on anthropological sciences derived from the theory of evolution. And no joke, this is a book about how to increase your reproductive potential, eliminate everything unnecessary in your life, and make sure that you are creating as many children as you possibly can. And it's dead serious. It's not satiric or anything. It's just... a book about how the only way to tell if you are winning in life is how well your genes are being spread. And so I kept the book.
Yeah, good.
And I actually got some strange emails from him, right?
Yeah.
And so I started asking around Harvard about him, and Harvard didn't want to talk about him, and he was the only person who ever was an alumni of Harvard who didn't show up in the Harvard databases. And it turns out he had been kicked out of Harvard because as an anthropology grad student, he had angered up the nation of Nairobi by stealing some artifacts.
Wait. He angered up the nation of Nairobi how?
By stealing some artifacts or trying to sell them. I'm a little vague on all that, and I can't find that information. So let's take that very much with a grain of salt, that part.
Oh.
What I'm about to tell you is absolutely 100% confirmed true. He also, it turns out, is credited as being the first person to ever attempt to unleash a computer virus.
Oh, my God.
And after he got kicked out of Harvard, he was applying for jobs at worldwide aid charities in the late 80s, and he didn't get anything. So he sent to all the charities, hundreds of them around the world, a diskette that was that he claimed had, really important database information for them that they all needed. And it had a worm or a virus in it that was designed to lock down their computers. And then a message would come up saying, if you don't send X amount of money to this address, you can't get your data back. So he tried to hold the world's data, the world's information hostage.
Did he get arrested? Or?
Oh, yeah. This blew up. He shows up in all the histories, all the early histories of computer viruses and computer attacks and computer terrorism. Really fascinating guy. So when I dug out the book and I wrote about it a while ago after I read, I was Googling him and read that he had died.
Like I'm sad.
He writes this book that I think is just absolutely wonderful. He opened up a butterfly sanctuary in upstate New York.
Okay. You know, that's probably the best thing he ever did in his life, yeah. But
I can't argue with that. And, I mean, if there's one way to maximize your reproductive potential, it's opening up a butterfly sanctuary.
Hey, you know, Alan, let me ask you a couple of quickie questions also about the fact that, you know, you had your whole life based in Kansas City. Then you move first to L.A., then to now you're moving to San Francisco. But since you are a crap archivist, do you have very, very tolerant parents who just let you have the whole basement? Or what do you, because you're obviously not going to throw stuff out. You can't. It's your treasures. What do you do?
I have a tolerant girlfriend's parents right now who are storing a lot of books for me.
Yeah.
My room here in Los Angeles is stocked with terrible, terrible books. And I have taught myself to finally start letting go of some that I've already written about.
Oh, wow. So you're eBaying them and all that?
Occasionally. I don't eBay many of them because most of them are definitely of limited interest to the world.
To anybody, yeah.
But I have eBayed a couple. I think I got over $100 for a book called How to Live with a Bitch from 1968. It was not ironic either, this book. It was about gender relations.
Okay.
But no, mostly I put them, you know how when you catch a small fish and you release it. I very much like to take my books back to used bookstores.
Yes.
And just let them re-enter the stream.
That's actually, let me ask, what is, I probably should have asked this right up front, but what is the criterion for you? Or what are the criteria? Sorry, old English habits coming out. For crap, for what constitutes crap for your column?
Boy, that gets tricky. To me, it has to be something that was conceived with some purpose in mind that it fails. And that gets to be a very tricky question, because I can't just say, like, you know, a book like Fuzzy Mule's Pink Slippers is, you know, a terrible novel, but it's meant to be funny. But sometimes it's the attempts in it to be funny that are themselves funny. So that gets, that, you know, it kind of gets into a snake swallowed its own tail territory there. But so, I mean, I think maybe the easiest way to do it is just to kind of list the kind of things I find myself writing about again and again. It's, you know, one of my favorite things is crazy old books by crazy old preachers. And my favorite being Tim LaHaye, the inventor of the Left Behind series, who in the late 60s wrote a remarkable book titled How to Be Happy Though Married.
That's actually a very reasonable, that's not an unreasonable title, really.
Exactly. And if that book had a picture of Paul Reiser on it, it would not be crap. It'd just be boring.
Yeah.
A guy offering marriage advice, it's a very different situation. That in the book is endlessly hilarious. But, you know, but, I mean, honestly, sometimes it is just time that can make something really kind of crappy. I have a really strong weakness for old magazines that are not, you know, not the old magazines you find. For some reason, going to estate sales, you discover that every American Family saves National Geographic, Playboy, and every Life with a picture of John Kennedy on the cover. But there's not many other magazines they save. So when I find a trove of Boy's Life or something, you know, I'm in heaven, because a 1968 Boy's Life is going to have things that will blow your mind in it.
Such as? Do you remember anything?
I wrote one recently, and it had a column written by Miss Teen USA where she instructs her boys that they don't need to be different like the hippies, and that when you be different, you're just being like everybody else.
Well, that's not unreasonable advice either. Come to the... I have to say...
Aren't they then supposed to be like Miss Teen USA?
Oh, well. No, but... It occurs to me too. No, but sometimes I do take issue with the column where you'll pick something that is kind of crappy and dated and silly, but you know, it you read the advice, and that's the funny part about these things. A lot of the times, like 80% is perfectly good, reasonable, normal, logical, useful stuff in these self-help books. And then it's that other 20%. And that's where it just goes a little bit, you know. Like the guy on the train who's talking normally and then goes into outer space. Like,
well, and I like to try to acknowledge where the crap is not crappy and focus on the really strange stuff. Like in The Boy's Life I'm talking about, there's a short story in there from Isaac Asimov.
Ooh.
You know, and so in a way, it's not just making fun of The Boy's Life. It's looking at how much more ambitious, you know, the press used to be. Especially whenever I write about old magazines, it always ends up being a little nostalgic, I'm almost sorry to say, for, you know, the state of publishing, for the state of literacy in America. But then, of course, I'll spend a lot of time on the crazy ads in the back for, you know, order a monkey through the mail.
Remember those little sea monkeys? I...
Oh, yeah. Or, no, in The Boy's Life, they have real monkeys.
What?
Also had predictions of what the computerized schoolhouse of the future will be like, and they illustrate this with photos of kids wearing space suits and clipboards.
Oh my God! And you know what? It actually all in some ways it reminds me. It brings back that what was it? Atomic Cafe? That documentary from I guess 25 years ago now. Of looking back at what everybody was telling children around the atomic age after World War II and during the Red Scare and the Iron Curtain and all that, the Cold War. And it's just, you know, if you go under your desk, everything, you'll be okay. the radiation will pass over you. And people bought it. It was the accepted. It wasn't. Didn't seem. I'm sure some people thought it was silly back then. If you had half a brain, you must have. But you did, because what else could you do? Would you be safer running into a closet? Would you be safer if you're a Japanese person right now? They're saying where you're just taping plastic bags over yourself. I mean, they're doing silly
and
things
now
today.
There's that kind of interesting phenomenon in the press where our press is trying to tell us, oh, by the way, that's just kind of an emotional response to think that a nuclear disaster would be the worst disaster. Have you noticed this strain in some of the coverage? And, you know, that's one of the things I find really valuable in going back and looking at this weird crap, or even not so weird crap like an old Boy's Life. Or just yesterday I was reading the 1978 Time magazine with John Travolta on the cover, and that's pretty fascinating too.
Yeah.
Is you can see in it how we became who we are, like what were the national assumptions back then, and how have they changed, how have they been ingrained?
There's value. It's the column is hilariously funny, but you're also bringing out the value of looking back on America, both its weirdness and its strange, skewed nostalgia. So there's a value to that as well. And I want to ask the last question for Alan Sherstuhl, the author of the weekly column Studies in Crap, which, you know, all you got to do is just put Studies in Crap in your Google browser, because I know now that you've heard the interview, everybody, you're going to want to do this immediately and every single week. As a matter of fact, is there a way that people can subscribe to, like, get a Twitter tweet about it or some kind of RSS feed?
My Twitter name is just Studies in Crap at Twitter with no spaces in it. And if you email me at Studies in Crap, just, again, no spaces in it, at pitch.com, that's P as in pitch, what is it, P in? P as in pineapple?
Okay, that'll do.
Studies in Crap at pitch.com, P-I-T-C-H. You can get on the big mailing list. That quite likely will soon be the crap at sfweekly.com, but we'll deal with that when it happens.
But here's the last question for Alan. Now that you've got this big job that you're starting, I guess, what, in 2 weeks? When do you start at SF Weekly as the editor?
Next Monday.
Wow. So What are your ambitions there? What's your vision for San Francisco Weekly?
Well, Dave, I'm glad you asked that. This is strong paper with a journalistic staff that right now, the reporting staff, I think really can't be beat. You were talking about circumcision in San Francisco earlier. I would direct you to, if you want to understand how such a thing could happen, I would direct you and the good rabbi to look up SF Weekly writer Joe Eskenazi's coverage of the Happy Meal ban in San Francisco in the SF Weekly quite a while ago.
Okay.
Where he really lays out how, you know, this kind of ban can only happen in this city. And so, you know, what I really want to do is more coverage like that, of that kind of excitement and caliber, that's explaining, you know, how this city is like one of the world's great cities and also one of the world's most delightfully strange ones.
I get it. I love San Francisco. Been there a couple of times. And hey, and you've been there at least once or twice in your life. So do you have a feel for the city yet?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I lived in Berkeley for a year.
Oh, okay. Cool. So
weird. And after living in Berkeley, I went back to the Midwest. And so it was like going from a place where everybody agrees with me about everything to a place where I'm a communist. So I enjoyed that quite a bit.
Yeah, this is as close as we get to a liberal radio station in this part of the world. I'll tell you that. You know, that's why I'm happy to be on this college thing.
I'm always amazed when I hear what you're getting away with out there, Dave. So, you know, keep that up.
Thank you, sir. Well, it's college radio, dude. It just, you know. Well, anyway, keep getting away with the marvelous work that you're doing. First, you know, congratulations almost on the upcoming master's. Have you finished your work then? Are you done with your coursework?
I submitted my thesis yesterday, and I have a couple more weeks of courses I have made arrangements for as I move it about the country.
Well, you're going to do them on the web?
Yeah, that kind of thing, and come back down occasionally a bit. We'll see. We'll figure it out.
Yeah. Well, you're not going to be that far away. I mean, it's almost drivable from L.A. to San Francisco.
Yeah, it's 350 miles or thereabouts.
Yeah. Yeah, you go. You know, you can get one of those old magazines about getting here to there in a space age sort of a way, and you can just mentally teleport. You know?
I don't think that bullet train's ever going to happen.
Not with the economy the way it is. Well, Alan, it has been an absolute delight and so much fun to talk with you about your work, your life, and, of course, the column, Studies in Crap. And all I can do is wish you much, much more and greater success when you go to San Francisco.
Hey, thank you, Dave. And, you know, give my love to the rabbi, please.
I certainly will. Thanks, Alan.